I'd like to get back to, well, Jack's comment and question. Why is it? That is, it appears that if you did a very systematic, objective, historical, engaged in historical scholarship in which you just followed the evidence and you did not censor yourself, that in our public document, right, this is still a, even though there is censorship and self-censorship, this is still a relatively free society in which in our libraries and on the internet, etc., there's a vast amount of information about all of this, especially things in the past. You know, now we know about what happened in Guatemala, and of course you will read about it in very excruciating detail in Greg Grandin's book, but many of us at that time, of course, I was 14 years old, I don't even know if we, you know, other than studying our little brown neighbors to the south, whom we always loved, who knew what was going on in Guatemala? So many of those things were kept secret from the American people, from adults, and for those of us in high school at 14 years of age, I don't know what you were doing at 14 years of age, but you know, I was hoping the Yankees were going to beat the Cleveland Indians in the 54 pennant race. But who knew from Guatemala? Who knew what was happening? Who knew about Iran the year before when I was 13? So when I've struggled with this over 31 years of teaching and more than 6,500 students, most of whom, when they came into class, had not engaged in any critical work, did not know Zinn, did not know Chomsky. It was rare that, you know, they knew Jefferson, had never read the 10th Federalist paper, etc. As I think back with the luxury of hindsight 5 years down the road, I think one of the answers to the why is we simply were not exposed to critical perspectives that challenged the dominant view, which we were inundated with day in and day out by our teachers, by the mass media. I mean, some of us, I'm sure, you had a teacher now and then who would come in. I remember a high school history teacher would come in with The Nation and The New Republic and just go around. He was a very autocratic guy, but he went around and said, all right, I want you to read this article. I want you to do this. He introduced another way of looking at the world, and then The New Republic was quite liberal and to the left, which it, for those of you who haven't seen The New Republic lately, it is not. Okay, it has moved. So we didn't have the critical tools. Some of us didn't even know where Guatemala was or Iran. We couldn't have found it on a map. So I think part of it, because I sort of come out of this rationalist tradition that we can't challenge the dominant view if we don't know some basic history. So I was helpless. And I don't think I was unique in East High School in Rochester, New York in the 1950s. My experience was repeated generation after generation. So I think that's one of the answers, that the things we're going to read are not still widely available. They're much more available today than they were 50 years ago. I mean, those of you who are in the Zinn group, Howard Zinn's People's History has sold 1 million copies in the United States, and that means more than 1 million people reading it. It is used in some high schools. It is used in many college classrooms. That kind of history was not there in the 50s and even the 60s. So it's not having everything on the table and then not having mentors to help us analyze, challenge, I mean, the kinds of questions, Lauren, you raised, where we can have a debate and a real dialogue and argue it out and see which perspective really holds up. Where's the evidence for these arguments? And that's something we have to come back to, because we're not the mainstream in this room, in case any of you had any illusions about that. Okay? We are not. We are not. Okay? Most people don't read Zinn. They haven't heard of Howard Zinn or Noam Chomsky. They don't read Dunbar Ortiz. And it has nothing to do with their brainwaves or anything. It's just you need the opportunity. It has to be introduced. So,
my name is Ken Hunzinski, and I realize this is a history sort of a review, not theoretical, but I was wondering if you could separate the economic system and what the impact. The question I'm sort of asking is, what if we had a war and nobody profited? I mean, what would be the impact? No, I mean, it's serious. How much does the money have to do with it?
Well, as you'll see from William's book, from this article briefly, you'll certainly see in Dunbar Ortiz's article, you'll certainly see in John Bellamy Foster's article, that you can't separate economics from history and politics. They are linked. Everything is linked. I mean, you can pull them out as a scholar or a student to analyze them and say, okay, what happened economically with the banks, et cetera, et cetera. As long as you remember that you're abstracting something that in the real world is connected, you can do it because we have the power to do that. You say, well, you know, I'm only going to look at the economic part. So you will see with the readings that we will be doing that the nature of resources, the struggle of resources, the exploitation of surplus, the involvement of money in all of this is absolutely profound and is not unique to U.S. imperialism and has been the crux of empires over eons of time in terms of the struggle over resources. It has to be glossed. You got to tell a story after all. I mean, it'd be pretty difficult, whether it was the French in Indochina or the Belgians in the Congo or the U.S., to really come out front and say, listen, we're going in, you know, I'm King Leopold, we're going into the Belgian Congo, we're going to kill, it may be 10 million people. It was one of the incredible genocides of the 20th or any century, again, of which none of us knew virtually anything, by the way. And I'm doing this so that I can ride in these really great horse-drawn carriages and have jewels and have lunch with Queen Frederica, whoever was his queen at that time. That rhetoric can't be said because it's too blatant. People would get it. So at base, I am going to argue a political economy thesis. That's what the thrust of the readings will be, and that's how we will proceed.
My name is Woody Nance. I think what we're talking about is this dominant narrative, and along with that is people's resistance or people's movements. I guess I got that from Howard Zinn, reading, studying Howard Zinn's book. So we have had people, oppressed people, and people who are discriminated against, and et cetera, who have fought back against the dominant narrative. But let us go back to Queen Isabella in Spain. I mean, she wanted two things. She wanted to find gold and land, and she wanted, since she was a Catholic nation, she wanted to spread the Catholic faith. And so this is the same thing that happened in Latin America and other parts of Africa and so forth when Protestant missionaries went over there and then big corporations came right behind them. I guess my question is, I think some of these people are rationalizing and they really do believe that they deserve to have this economic advantage because they're better or superior or whatever. Maybe they really have brainwashed themselves into believing that. But I do think that other people are just cynical and they don't mind using this. I think that's what's happening today. I suspect that's what is happening with the Bush regime. I think most of them are just cynical people who don't care, who if they're on the Titanic, they don't care as long as they're in the best suite. You know, if their policies are causing the whole planet to go down. And so some of these people are just using religious ideas and this, that, and the other to get the economic gain that they want. Now, we do have some resistance. I mean, we're really struggling right now in this country with, okay, can we break the Geneva International Law and really do torture? Can we do away with habeas corpus, that one of the most basic parts of our Constitution? And so there is resistance, which I think the resistance and the movements of people is what makes me feel good about being in the U.S., not the ruling class, not the imperialist ruling class.
All right. Yeah.
Hi, my name is Mona Levine, and I wanted to respond to your idea because I don't think it's an either-or thing. It isn't what we have now or isolationism. What we really need in the world is to share the resources of the world. It should be a redistribution of the world's resources. If we help other countries, believe me, the people in the country will be greatly appreciative. An example of that is in Cuba. In Cuba, they train doctors, thousands of them every year, and they send them all over the world. There's a wonderful movie called Like Angels, and you see the people responding to these doctors. They are so appreciative. And now they are not only training their doctors to go all over the world, they are now training people from all over the world to come to Cuba, learn how to be a doctor, and go back to their own country and help them. And that kind of kindness, or whatever you want to call it, is what will change the world. It's about sharing the resources, all our resources. We don't need to live so wealthy. It's so materialistic in our world. We can live a lot more simply and get a lot more out of it.
Just a note. And in order to begin to get the dialogue moving and to begin to sort of piece together different reflections. But as much as possible, as I indicated, we want to try not to go from 0 to 100. Try not to go from the analysis to what we should do. Because I think what will happen is we will go around the reading and around the arguments, and because they are distressing, we'll then understandably want to talk about what it has been done in Cuba, which has per capita more doctors outside its borders than any country in the world. But just try to resist that when you get into the reading, because again, otherwise it'll end up being, you know, how do we fix this immediately without the diagnosis?
My name is Brian, and John's normal, splendid presentation. He touched lightly on the territorial imperative of empire, and I think it should be expanded upon. The English gave up India as a territory in 1947. They didn't give up their economic power over India in 1947. In fact, they hold considerable economic power still over India. And it indicates a time of transition. The last 50 years has provided some great opportunity to have economic power over another nation. And it's definitely an empire, and it's definitely an imperial control. Well, without going into the history, I just think it should be something that we should discuss more thoroughly.
So is this on? Hi, my name is Turaj. In response to your comment or question about the psyche, it's a very profound question, I think. And part of it has to do with the fact that our foreign policy has been off the table from a democratic discussion. We are not to discuss our foreign policies. This is left to the experts. Is left to the State Departments and the PhDs and the people who know how to deal with it. And for the rest of us, we just basically listen to what they have to say. So the leadership, and especially the executive power, they have the resources and the know-how to do the foreign policy, and we cannot argue with them. And I think that's a great source of distress for the rest of us.
One of the things that Williams will discuss in the book, and I think Bellamy Foster also gets to it, but Williams certainly, is that the imperial state, and especially post-World War II United States, that the dramatic increase in power in the executive branch of government to create the conditions for war and take us to war, and the removing of Congress, for the most part, from a democratic deliberation. Because as you recall, Article 1, Section 8 of the United States Constitution states very clearly that it's not vague, as they say the Geneva Convention might be, Congress shall declare war. The United States Congress has not declared war since December 8, 1941, when Franklin Roosevelt went before Congress after the United States was attacked at Pearl Harbor. The United States has been involved in hundreds of covert and overt armed incidents since that time. There have been some resolutions, but there has not been a single declaration of war. So Williams is going to argue that the whole democratic nature of society, which means public dialogue on the fundamental issues, in which, of course, there are people who may be expert in an area and study a region of the world, but that it must always be brought to the democratic dialogue, the governing body of the country. That increasingly has been removed. And he, of course, in 1980 and through the end of his life, found that very, very distressing. That doesn't guarantee that in a real democratic debate that your perspective about whether we should go to war or not is going to be the one that passes. But just the idea that this is a momentous decision, the most fundamental decision a government takes is to go to war. And, you know, there have been some debates. You remember there was a debate before the first Gulf War, right? It was a resolution. It was not a declaration of war. The resolution in October 2002, which gave Bush the approval to do whatever he thought was necessary. Again, there was debate and discussion, but it was a resolution. It was not a declaration of war. So that's an issue we have to come back to.
Hi, Jay Johnson again. Earlier tonight, I submitted that there could be, or that there is, both positive imperialism and negative imperialism. I'd like to get feedback on three other kinds that I've come up with. One is territorial imperialism, which is the classical territorial-based imperialism we all are familiar with throughout history. But the other two, one is market imperialism, where it's not control of a property, of our territory. It's actual control of the markets, which I think is the new phase, the more sophisticated 21st century phase of imperialism, which is market imperialism. And the third would be ideological imperialism, such as socialist movements over the last 50 years to develop socialism internationally as an ideology, and in some cases not be tolerant of opposition to it, as compared obviously to capitalist ideology, which of course is overwhelmingly the dominant now.
So for example, a market imperialism would be in which
Where you do not control the country, but you do control the market. NAFTA jumps to mind as an example.
Okay.
Or conversely, the Caribbean countries have Mercantour, where Mercantour is not imperialist, it's just the opposite. It's a non-imperialist. NAFTA would be the perfect example today. But there have been historical, the control of the Seven Sisters of the oil riches of the Middle East.
Right.
That would be market imperialism. We didn't control the countries. We just controlled all the resources, which is all that mattered. And there's 50 other examples of market imperialism.
So these are different forms of imperialism. So therefore, and the one, especially market imperialism, neoliberalism, etc., far more than the overt invasions of countries. But still, the object, you would argue, is you can control the nature of a country in the interest of some in a dominant...
You just want to control their resources. You could care less about the country.
Right.
That's what's going on in the United States, is where the power elite is controlling your resources could care less about the people in this country. We're doing it to ourselves.
Okay.
And the other would be ideological imperialism.
So,
Mansoor.
My name's Mansoor. You mentioned something about the imperialist system having a ruling class. And I would like to expand on the ruling class, that what are this ruling class's issues? And those issues will become as of ideology. And the ideology is interpreted for us, the commoners, or at least for me, the commoner. And we carry that ideology within us of somebody else, of some different class, that I have it in my brain, right? That it says, I'm the American, I'm the better than the guy in India. I'm better than the guy in Africa because they get $1 per day for what they do, and I buy a coffee, it's $2. I want to break it down to what it is that I'm carrying with me, okay, that ideology. And part of that ideology or interpretation or the psyche would be the culture and the language that we use. Is it my language that I'm using? What am I representing here? Am I representing the ruling class? And who's this ruling class in my language and lexicon that I'm using? Or am I using working class language or internationalist language, or as the gentleman in the corner alluded to, that I'm a planetarian citizen rather than, you know, just because I'm born here, I'm not guilty. Okay, so with that in mind, then what I really would like to learn, it's the benefit of this system. Who's benefiting from it? If the working class is benefiting from this system, what is the comparison? I mean, if the guy who causes the war and goes after the resources in Yugoslavia and gets $10 billion the first day and I'm getting one extra cup of coffee, I'd like to know that. You know, am I getting 2 cents per his $2 million, you know, as a working class? Okay, so I think if we break this one down, then my last point would be, as a citizen, what am I going to do? How am I going to fight my fights? You know, if I get in the street and I want to say, come and join me for this struggle, do I just say, hooray, 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 I'm an American and I'm anti-war, but I can reap the benefits of soldiers being in Iraq, and I can just walk around, drive around in this city, up to yin-yang of the hours of the day, go to restaurants, what have you, right? But I'm still saying, I'm anti-war, you know? How are we going to interpret all this? How are we going to bring this thing down that... Hopefully at the end of this year, we can break down to the dialogue that we have. So at least we would find out in this society, who is my enemy, really? I mean, literally that I can fight against for in a cultural way, not with any sort of deadly weapons or so. And just one last thing, anybody under age of 40, please raise your hand here. Under 40, okay? So here's part of the culture that we carry with us, and that is, we don't have teenagers with us. So maybe next time we come, bring a teenager with you. I have promised myself I'm going to bring one teenager with me so he can sit and learn from all this. You know, at least if nothing else, he will sit in quietly back there, get bored to death. But at the end of 1 year, once a month, this is how the changes come. You got to bring somebody with you who doesn't know these things.
And if we just continue doing the same thing over and over, might as well go find an island and live there.
As you were talking about the sort of these dominant ideologies, the language, especially in the West, especially in societies like the United States and Western Europe, Japan, Canada, Australia. Iving, one of the best people who's written on this, was the Italian Antonio Gramsci, who wrote about ideological hegemony. Gramsci actually was in the same socialist group with Mussolini. They went different ways, and Mussolini ended up throwing Gramsci in prison, where he stayed for 11 or 12 years and then died shortly thereafter. But Gramsci went on to be one of the founders of the Italian Communist Party and wrote about how do you maintain dominance in a society without always reverting to coercion and violence, which, of course, happens and has happened in the United States. But for the most part, people believe, going back to why we believe things, most of us in this society have grown to believe these things, not because somebody beat us up and threw us into prison. They're like what Gramsci called breathing in education. You breathe in the taken for granted. What we think, what we take for granted are the most important things about a society. And how that defines how we see ourselves, how we see each other, how we see the United States in the Philippines in 1902, in Vietnam in 1965, in Indonesia, etc. And so if I've internalized that, and Hollis talked about ideological hegemony, if I've internalized those dominant views, remember both groups have to internalize this, the dominant group and the dominated group. Now the dominant group is the one that has the access and the power and the media. The dominated group, in a sense, is taking it in. But if I internalize that, I mean, you don't need a lot of police. You carry the police around in your head, okay? And we're free in this society to ask any of the kinds of questions we're asking tonight, all sorts of questions. But if I haven't been helped again critically with the tools to ask those questions, I'm helpless against the history that I've learned. And that's why we will always, always focus on history in this group, because without a knowledge of the past, you cannot face the future. Historical amnesia is one of the big things in this society. So thanks for getting that out. So I will see people next month. Anyone wants these lecture notes, please send me an email.
You have been listening to Empire as a Way of Life, a lecture and discussion series given by Dr. John Marciano. This group meets monthly until June of 2007 at the Ken Edwards Center in Santa Monica, California. Contact Dr. Marciano at johnmarciano@mac.com. This program was produced by the LA Sound Posse. The LA Sound Posse records speeches and events dealing with social justice issues. We use the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, Share-alike 2.5 license to ensure the ongoing public availability of these recordings. We share them via the Internet, community radio, and CDs distributed through grassroots social justice groups, nonprofit organizations, committed individuals, and others. Our goal is to be a part of the creation of a broad-based, participatory, and democratic civic media in support of a truly democratic society. You can reach us on the web at www.lasoundposse.org. If you value what you heard in this program, please feel free to copy and distribute it to others who you think would benefit from hearing it, and thus becoming yourself a part of a decentralized, democratic civic media.
When the rich man said this world's mine, when he asked which side you're on, told you to step in line, when he gave his reasons for his war of conquest, when he talked about your wallet, said it was in your interest, did you shrug your shoulders, do as you were told, hang a flag in your window, goods that you were sold, or did you shut off his craven image, call the man a liar, did you strike a blow against the empire, did you strike a blow against the empire, lost their lives, lying broken on the pavement as the ambulance arrives. As the soldiers open fire with their heavy guns, could you hear the demonstrators hit the ground? See how their red blood runs. What were you doing in those fateful times? Did you raise your voice against these awful crimes? Were you hiding in your bedroom when the situation was so dire? Or did you strike a blow against the empire? Did you strike a blow against the empire? At your door, when the fascist state was here and they brought home the war, when the Gestapo was in the city and they had really taken power, when there was nothing left to do here in the final hour, did you find a place to run to and hope to live a few more years when the slaughter was around you? Did you cover up your ears, or did you set your sights, take your aim and fire? Did you strike a blow against the empire? Did you strike a blow against the empire? Did you strike a blow?
Listener, for the past couple of months, I've been reading weekly from a book on the underground history of American education by John Taylor Gatto. Gatto was a schoolteacher in New York City for 30 years. In 1991, after having been named New York State Teacher of the Year, he announced he was leaving the profession because he'd concluded that our educational system was dumbing us down instead of improving our minds, as it claims to do. He began to research why this should be so, and this book is the result of a decade of investigation. What Gatto found is that the goals of compulsory education in America, as articulated by many of the leading pedagogues and supporters who guided its formation, was to manufacture a certain kind of person that they considered a good citizen, obedient, conformist, ready to work in a factory or cubicle. And this has resulted in a dumbed-down population because creativity, imagination, initiative, critical thinking, the attributes of intelligence, are stunted by this mass production approach to education. Gatto has written of some of the top educational theorists who influenced the design of our education system as viewing children as, quote, machines capable of infinite adjustments. Gatto has contrasted this approach by giving us stories of the education of some of the major figures of revolutionary America, all of them homeschooled and self-educated. And he has provided statistics from military records showing how American literacy has declined over the 20th century. All of our past programs are archived on the web at unwelcomeguest.org, so you can download previous shows with earlier readings if you so desire. This week we begin The Lure of Utopia, Chapter 6 of John Taylor Gatto's Underground History of American Education. Presumably, humane utopian interventions like compulsion schooling aren't always the blessing they appear to be. For instance, Sir Humphrey Davy's safety lamp saved thousands of coal miners from gruesome death, but it wasted many more lives than it rescued. That lamp alone allowed the coal industry to grow rapidly, exposing miners to mortal danger for which there is no protection. What Davy did for coal producers, forced schooling has done for the corporate economy. And Gatto begins the chapter with this quote by Henry Steele Commager. Every morning when you picked up your newspaper, you would read of some new scheme for saving the world. Soon all the zealots, all the come-outers, all the transcendentalists of Boston gathered at the Chardon Street Chapel and harangued each other for 3 mortal days. And they talked on non-resistance and the Sabbath reform, of the church and the ministry, and they arrived at no conclusions. It was the most singular collection of strange specimens of humanity that was ever assembled, wrote Edmund Quincy, and Emerson was even more specific. Madmen, madwomen, men with beards, dunkers, muggletonians, come-outers, groaners, agrarians, Seventh-day Baptists, Quakers, abolitionists, Calvinists, Unitarians, and philosophers— all came successively to the top and seized their moment, if not their hour, wherein to chide or pray or preach or protest. There was something artificial about the Chardon Street debates. There was a hothouse atmosphere in the chapel. There was too much suffering fools gladly, there was too much talk, too much display of learning and wit, and there was, for all the talk of tolerance, an unchristian spirit. Close quote. The cries of true believers are all around the history of schooling, thick as gulls at a garbage dump. School principal Debbie Reeves of the upscale Barnwell Elementary School in an Atlanta suburb was quoted recently by the USA Today newspaper as the author of this amazing testimonial of true belief. Quote, "I'm not sure you ever get to the point you have enough technology. We just believe so fervently in it," close quote. It's that panting excitement you want to keep an eye out for, that exaggerated belief in human perfectibility that Tocqueville noticed in America 170 years ago. The same newspaper article wanders through the San Juan Elementary School in the very heart of Silicon Valley. There, obsolete computers sit idle in neat rows at the back of a spacious media center, where years ago a highly touted open classroom with a sunken common area drew similar enthusiasm. The school lacks resources for the frequent updates needed to boast state-of-the-art equipment. A district employee said, "One dying technology on top of a former dying technology, sort of like layers of an archaeological dig." America has always been a land congenial to utopian thought. The Mayflower Compact is a testimonial to this. Although its signers were trapped in history, they were ahistorical too, capable of acts and conceptions beyond the imagination of their parents. The very thinness of constituted authority, the high percentage of males as colonists, homeless, orphaned, discarded, marginally attached, uprooted males, encouraged dreams of a better time to come. Here was soil for a better world, where kindly strangers take charge of children, loving and rearing them more skillfully than their ignorant parents had ever done. Religion flourished in the same medium, too, particularly the independent and dissenting religious traditions of England. The extreme rationalism of the Socinian heresy and deism, twin roots of America's passionate romance with science and technology to come, flourished too. Most American sects were built on a Christian base, but the absence of effective state or church monopoly authority in early America allowed 250 years of exploration into a transcendental dimension no other Western nation ever experienced in modern history, leaving a wake of sects and private pilgrimages which made America the heir of ancient Israel, a place where everyone, even freethinkers, actively trusted in a god of some sort. Without pope or patriarch, without an Archbishop of Canterbury, the episcopal principle behind state and corporate churches lacked teeth, allowing people here to find their own way in the region of soul and spirit. This turned out to be fortunate, a precondition for our laboratory policy of national utopianism, which required that every sort of visionary be given scope to make a case. It was a matter of degree, of course. most Americans, most of the time, were much like people back in England, Scotland, Scandinavia, Germany, Ireland, from which domains they had originally derived. After all, the revolution itself was prosecuted by less than a quarter of our population. But enough of the other sort existed as social yeast that nobody could long escape some plan, scheme, exhortation, or tract designed to lead the faithful into one or another promised land. For the most part, Old Testament principles reigned, not new, and the prophets had a good part of the national ear. From 1830 to 1900, over 1,000 utopian colonies flourished around the country, colonies which mixed the races like Fanny Wright's Neshoba in Tennessee, colonies built around intensive schooling like New Harmony in Indiana, colonies which encouraged free love and commonly shared sexual partners, as did the perfectionists at Oneida in upstate New York. In the wonderful tapestry of American utopian thought and practice, one unifying thread stands out clearly. Long before the notion of forced schooling became household reality, utopian architects universally recognized that schooling was the key to breaking with the past. The young had to be isolated and drilled in the correct way of looking at things, or all would fall apart when they grew up. Only the tiniest number of these intentional communities ever did solve that problem, and so almost all vanished after a brief moment. But the idea itself lingered on. In this chapter, I want to push a bit into the lure of utopia, because this strain in human nature crisscrosses the growth curve of compulsion schooling at many junctures. Think of it as a search for the formula to change human nature in order to build paradise on earth. Such an idea is in flagrant opposition to the dominant religion of the Western world, whose theology teaches that human nature is permanently flawed, that all human salvation must be individually undertaken. Even if you aren't used to considering school this way, it isn't hard to see that a curriculum to reach the first end would have to be different from that necessary to reach the second, and the purpose of the educator is all important. It's simply impossible to evaluate what you see in a school without knowing its purpose. But if local administrators have no real idea why they do what they do, why they administer standardized tests, for instance, then any statement of purpose made by the local school can only confuse the investigator. To pursue the elusive purpose or purposes of American schooling as they were conceived about a century ago requires that we wander far afield from the classroom into some flower beds of utopian aspiration which reared their heads in an earlier America. And I'm reading from John Taylor Gatto's The Underground History of American Education. Herzler's History of Utopian Thought traces the influence of Francis Bacon's New Atlantis, a book you need to know something about if you are to ever adequately understand the roots of modern schooling. Herzler makes a good case from the testimony of its founders that the Royal Society itself arose from the book's prophetic scheme of Solomon's House, a world university assembling the best of universal mankind under its protection, one of its functions to oversee management of everything. The New Atlantis had immense influence in England, Germany, Italy, and France. In France, it was considered the principal inspiration of the Encyclopedia, whose connection to the American Revolution is a close one. The story has been told too many times to bear repeating here. Suffice it to say that the very same triangle-encased eye that appears on the back of the American dollar appears as the center of Solomon's Temple in early 18th century French artistic representations. Our consistent requirement of utopian procedure is the detachment of its subjects from ordinary human affairs. Acting with detached intelligence is what utopians are all about. But a biological puzzle intrudes. Detaching intelligence from emotional life isn't actually possible. The feat has never been performed, although imaginative writers are endlessly intrigued by the challenge it presents. Sherlock Holmes or Mr. Spock of Star Trek fame come to mind. Utopian thinking is intolerant of variety or competition, so the tendency of modern utopians to enlarge their canvas to include the whole planet through multinational organizations becomes disturbing. Utopians regard national sovereignty as irrational and democracy as a disease unjustified by biological reality. We need one world, they say, and that one world should reasonably be under the direction of the best utopians. Democracy degrades the hierarchy necessary to operate a rational policy. A feature of nearly all utopias has been addiction to elaborate social machinery like schooling and what we can call marvelous machinery. Excessive human affection between parents, children, husbands, wives, and all is suppressed to allow for enthusiasm for machine magic to stand out in bold relief. There is a legend that in Lost Atlantis once stood a great university in the form of an immense flat-topped pyramid from which star observations were made. In this university, most of the arts and sciences of the present world were contained. Putting aside that pleasant fancy, which we can find clearly reflected on the obverse of our American Great Seal, almost any early utopia holds a profusion of inside information about things to come. In 1641, Bishop John Wilkins, founder of the Royal Society, wrote his own utopia, Mercury, or The Secret and Swift Messenger. Every single invention Wilkins imagined has come about. A flying chariot, a trunk or hollow pipe that shall preserve the voice entirely, a code for communicating by means of noisemakers, etc. Japhantia by De La Roche unmistakably envisions the telephone, the radio, television, and dehydrated foods and drinks. Even the mechanisms suggested to make these things work are very like the actual ones eventually employed. Marshall McLuhan once called on us to notice that all machines are merely extensions of the human nervous system, artifices which improve on natural apparatus, each a utopianization of some physical function. Once you understand the trick, utopian prophecy isn't so impressive. Equally important, says McLuhan, the use of machinery causes its natural flesh-and-blood counterpart to atrophy, hence the lifeless quality of the utopias. Machines dehumanize, according to McLuhan, wherever they are used and however sensible their use appears. In a correctly conceived demonology, the devil would be perceived as a machine, I think. Yet, the powerful, pervasive influence of utopian reform thinking on the design of modern states has brought about utopian mechanization of all human functions into the councils of statecraft and into the curriculum of state schooling. An important part of the virulent, sustained attack launched against family life in the United States, starting about 150 years ago, arose from the impulse to escape fleshly reality. Interestingly enough, the overwhelming number of prominent social reformers since Plato have been childless, usually childless men, in a dramatic illustration of escape discipline employed in a living tableau. Beginning about 1840, a group calling itself the Massachusetts School Committee held a series of secret discussions involving many segments of New England political and business leadership. Stimulus for these discussions, often led by the politician Horace Mann, was the deterioration of family life that the decline of agriculture was leaving in its wake. A peculiar sort of dependency and weakness caused by mass urbanization was acknowledged by all with alarm. The once idyllic American family situation was giving way to widespread industrial serfdom. Novel forms of degradation and vice were appearing. And yet, at the same time, a great opportunity was presented. Plato, Augustine, Erasmus, Luther, Calvin, Hobbes, Rousseau, and a host of other insightful thinkers sometimes referred to the Boston Athenaeum as the Order of the Quest. all taught without compulsory universal schooling, the idiosyncratic family would never surrender its central hold on society to allow utopia to become reality. Family had to be discouraged from its function as a sentimental haven, pressed into the service of loftier ideals, those of the perfected state. Man saw that society's guards and securities had to increase because an unsuspected pathological phenomenon was following the introduction of mass production into life. It was producing artificial wants. It was multiplying the temptation to accumulate things. But the barbarous life of the machine laborer made family ideals a hollow mockery. Morality could no longer be taught by such families. Crime and vice were certain to explode unless children could be pried away from their degraded custodians and civilized according to formulas laid down by the best minds. Barnes Sears, man's Calvinist colleague, saw the rapid growth of commercial mass entertainment catering to dense urban settlements as a current of sensuality sweeping everything before it. Former bucolics, who once looked to nature for entertainment, were now pawns in the hands of worldly wise men vending commercial amusement. Urban confinement robbed men and women of their ability to find satisfaction outside the titillation of mechanical excitation. Whoever provided excitement became the master. Man's other colleague, George Boutwell, who would inherit the leadership of New England education from Sears, argued that a course must be selected from which there could be no turning back. Urbanization spelled the collapse of worker families. There was no remedy for it. Fathers were grossly diverted by non-agricultural labor from training their own children. Claims of a right to society and fashion led to neglect by mothers, too. As in some languages, there is no word which expresses the true idea of home, said Boutwell. So in our manufacturing towns, there are many persons who know nothing of its reality. Close quote. Man proclaimed the state must assert itself as primary parent of children. If an infant's natural parents were removed, or if parental ability failed, as was increasingly certain, it was the duty of government to step in and fill the parent's place. Mann noted that Massachusetts had a long tradition of being parental in government. His friend Sears described the state as a nourishing mother, as wise as she is beneficent. Yet, should difficulties arise, the state might become stern, as befits a ruling patriarch. Close quote. And I'm reading from John Taylor Gatto's The Underground History of American Education. The 1852 compulsory schooling legislation of Massachusetts represents a fundamental change in the jurisprudence of parental authority, as had the Adoption Act passed by the nearly identically constituted legislature just 4 years prior, the first formal adoption legislation anywhere on earth since the days of the Roman Empire. Acts so radical could not have passed silently into practice if fundamental changes in the status of husbands and wives, parents and children, had not already gravely damaged the prestige of the family unit. There are clear signs as far back as 1796 that elements in the new American state intended to interpose themselves in corners of the family where no European state had ever gone before. In that year, the Connecticut Superior Court, representing the purest Puritan lineage of original New England, introduced judicial discretion into the common law of child custody and a new conception of youthful welfare hardly seen before outside the pages of philosophy books. The notion that each child had an individual destiny, a private welfare independent of what happened to the rest of its family. A concept called psychological parenthood began to take shape, a radical notion without legal precedent that would be used down the road to support drastic forcible intervention into family life. It became one of the basic justifications offered during the period of mass immigration for a compulsion law intended to put children under the thrall of so-called scientific parenting in schools. Judicial discretion in custody cases was the first salvo in a barrage of poorly understood court rulings in which American courts made law rather than interpreted it. These rulings were formalized later by elected legislatures. Rubber-stamping the fait accompli, they marked a restructuring of the framework of the family ordered by a judicial body without any public debate or consent. No precedent for such aggressive court action existed in English law. The concept lived only in the dreams and speculations of utopian writers and philosophers. The 1840 case, Mersenne versus People, produced a stunning opinion by Connecticut's Justice Page, a strain of radical, strong state faith straight out of Hegel. Quote, "The moment a child is born, it owes allegiance to the government of the country of its birth and is entitled to the protection of the government." Close quote. As the opinion unrolled, Page further explained, "With the coming of civil society, the father's sovereign power passed to the chief or government of the nation." Close quote. A part of this power was then transferred back to both parents for the convenience of the state, but their guardianship was limited to the legal duty of maintenance and education, while absolute sovereignty remained with the state. Not since John Cotton, teacher of the Boston Church in the early Puritan period, has such a position been publicly asserted. Cotton, in renouncing Roger Williams, insisted on the absolute authority of magistrates in civil and religious affairs, the quintessential Anglican position. In later life, he even came to uphold the power of judges over conscience and was willing to grant the powers of life and death to authorities to bring about conformity. Thus did the Puritan rebellion rot from within. A few years after the Page ruling, American courts received a second radical authorization to intervene in family matters, the best interest of the child test. In 1847, Judge Oakley of New York City Superior Court staked a claim that such power is not unregulated or arbitrary, but is, quote, governed as far as the case will admit by fixed rules and principles. When such fixed rules and principles were not to be found, it caused no problem either, for it was only another matter subject to court discretion. In the 54-year period separating the Massachusetts compulsion school law adoption law and the founding of Children's Court at the beginning of the 20th century in Chicago, the meaning of these decisions became increasingly clear. With opposition from the family-centered societies of the Tidewater and Hill Country South, diminished by civil war, the American state assumed the parens patriae powers of old-time absolute kings, the notion of the political state as the primary father. And there were signs it intended to use those powers to synthesize the type of scientific family it wanted for the society it wanted, to usher in the future it wanted. And I'm reading from John Taylor Gatto's The Underground History of American Education. In the space of one lifetime, the United States was converted from a place where human variety had ample room to display itself into a laboratory of virtual orthodoxy, a process concealed by dogged survival of the mythology of independence. The cowboy and frontiersman continued as film icons until 1970, living ghosts of some collective national inspiration. But both died, in fact, shortly after Italian immigration began in earnest in the 1880s. The crucial years for the hardening of our national arteries were those between 1845 and 1920, the immigration years. Something subtler than Anglo-Saxon revulsion against Celt, Latin, and Slav was at work in that period. A utopian ideal of society as an orderly social hive had been transmitting itself continuously through small elite bodies of men since the time of classical Egypt. New England had been the New World proving ground of this idea. Now New England was to take advantage of the chaotic period of heavy immigration and the opportunity of mass regimentation afforded by civil war to establish this form of total state. The plan advanced in barely perceptible stages, each new increment making it more difficult for individual families to follow an independent plan. Ultimately, in the second and third decades of the 20th century, decades which gave us Adolf Hitler, prohibition, mass IQ testing of an entire student population, junior high schools, raccoon coats, Rudy Valley, and worldwide depression, room to breathe in a personal, peculiar, idiosyncratic way just ran out. It was the end of Thomas Jefferson's dream, the final betrayal of democratic promise in the last new world on the planet. When you consider how bizarre and implausible much of the conformist machinery put in place during this critical period really was, and especially how long and successfully all sorts of people resisted this kind of encroachment on fundamental liberty, it becomes clear that to understand things like universal medical policing, income tax, national banking systems, secret police, standing armies and navies which demand constant tribute, universal military training, standardized national examinations, the cult of intelligence tests, compulsory education, the organization of colleges around a scheme called research, which makes teaching an unpleasant inconvenience, the secularization of religion, the rise of specialist professional monopolies sanctioned by their state, and all the rest of the, quote, progress made in these 75 years. You have to find reasons to explain them. Why then? Who made it happen? What was the point? And we'll get to that question in our reading next week. I've been reading from John Taylor Gatto's The Underground History of American Education. Gatto is one of the nation's foremost advocates for homeschooling and self-directed education as a result of his 30 years as a public school teacher in New York City. You can find out more about his work and a documentary film project he's trying to organize on these same topics at his website, johntaylorgatto.com. And that's Gatto with two T's, GATTO.com. And you can download this and all previous editions of Unwelcome Guests as MP3s and podcasts at our website, unwelcomeguests.org. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening. One day and they'll kill me. Then I'll be gone, but that won't be my end. For my guns and my saddle will all